Carmen Barnett. I'd like to apologize for my handwritten testimony. I hope you all can read it.
It's very nice of you to have handwritten testimony. Some of the professional lobbyists don't even provide handwritten testimony. Could you turn the other microphone towards her, please? Thank you.
My testimony begins in the spring of 1972 at the U of O Medical School, where I had a Delcon shield inserted at the age of 21. The advice after the insertion was to have it cleansed and checked every 2 years, right along with my regular pap smear. In the course of 8 years, I had no problems, no difficulty, no spotting between menses, and it worked really well as a contraceptive. And then in May of 1980, in the early part of 19, in June, I arrived back in Oregon, and I had a temperature of 104, acute abdominal cramps, sweating, having coffee ground emesis, which is indicative of bleeding inside. And I arrived at St. Vincent's Hospital, where the doctor admitted me quite quickly with acute peritonitis. I was in the hospital for a week, and he was trying to not to operate on me, and it wasn't effective, so he had to go in and do a partial hysterectomy, taking my left ovary in tubes. And the other doctor with him wanted to also take my right side, but my doctor chose not to because I was 29 and single at the time, and he was thinking I'd be quite upset about it. And since St. Vincent's, I've had two more major surgeries, reconstructive surgery on my right tube, trying to get pregnant. And right now I'm 34 years old and not getting any younger. My husband and I can't conceive. And this is why I'm here to urge your full support in passing this bill and making Robbins Company accountable for placing a defective device on the open market for use. And not only has this ordeal caused me emotional stress, I've paid thousands of dollars in medical bills and time off from work, hours of severe physical pain. If you've ever had major surgery, you know, it's quite traumatic. It's extremely painful, and I've had three of them that I feel is a direct cause from the Delcon shield. It took me 5 years to even know what kind of IUD I had. I finally did get the information from my original doctor. And I feel all of this is a direct result. Whereas a young woman, I trusted that the Delcon shield would be a short-term contraceptive, not dreaming it would cause me to be childless and would eliminate the most treasured gift of all, a child.
Thank you. Let me see if there's questions from the committee members. Representative Burton.
Ms. Wecker. You, and I think you also were aware of the problem. I mean, it's something your insertion, you got the Delcon shield inserted in 1973, I believe. And then your surgery was in 1981. And at that time, you mentioned that your doctor said that he thought this was due to the Delcon shield. Was there any time in the intervening period between 1973 and 1981 that any of your doctors indicated that your problems may have been due to IUD, or was there any indication that it was a specific type of brand of item that was causing this problem? Either of you. I think you both had similar.
No.
Yours was not. No.
I had personal feelings that, yes, perhaps what I felt was something wrong with my body had been caused by that. But I went, as you can see from my testimony, I went to many doctors who could not verify or back up what my personal feelings were.
So over that period of 8 or 9 or so years, there was really no way to tell. You knew you had something wrong. There was no way to tell what it was until... And as I understand, the Robbins Company may have been aware of some problems much earlier than they announced it, but it didn't become commonly known to the medical practitioners who were doing these things until much later. So you really had no way of knowing what your problem was. There was no way to take redress prior to 1981, roughly, or 1982. So there was no legal recourse for you up to that time because you didn't know what it was. Thank you.
Further questions?
I'd like to add something. When I had my Delcon shield inserted, they said it didn't have to be clenstrol. After that, the next time I had a pap smear, the doctor said that it naturally cleanses itself. The floor in the vaginal tract will cleanse it. And there was no need to take the coil or the Delcon Shield out and cleanse it, because the body would do it naturally. And the articles that I read went right along with this concept. So that it does change, you know, medical field does, in their concepts.
Could I ask, I guess, were all of you counseled by your doctor in terms of the various types or brands of IUDs, and were you offered a choice, and were you offered advice in terms of a preference of one over another?
I was counseled. I was very cautious about birth control of all kinds, so I spent a lot of time speaking to various people about the various kinds of birth control, and I decided that an IUD seemed to be the best for me. I wouldn't have to remember to take a pill every day or have it on hand at all times. And when I made the decision for the IUD, I was told by the doctor that there were several different kinds on the market, but the only kind that he would recommend to a woman who had never had children was the Delcon Shield.
And that I had high blood pressure, so I could do pill. And the Delcon Shield was supposed to be for women who hadn't been pregnant before, so that's why I chose it.
I was the same. Not that not pregnancy, but had never delivered a baby. Had carried up
to term.
Full term.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I think there are some individuals that wanted to express their support of this measure. Ms. Thompson and Linda Lander, I believe.
I'm representing myself, and I ask for your support as well.
Thank you. Ms. Lander? Adelise?
I represent myself, and I do support.
Thank you. Donna Cloud?
I represent myself, and I support the bill.
Thank you very much. I believe that, I think there are some other individuals. Lorene Bay? Darla Chandler.
I represent myself, and my story is very much the same as the three ladies that you heard from, and I support them.
Thank you. Joyce Williams. Quite hear you at the end.
That's not the women that have never had children. It's everyone.
Thank you very much. Before I call Ms. Francis, I think Representative Burton has a question of Mr. Williams.
Mr. Williams, I just want to get some clarification of the bill by using an example of one of the people who testified. Miss Wecker's case, and I'm using that because I can pronounce her name and I can't pronounce Miss Lewentag, but they're very, very similar. Their problem, under the provisions of this bill, the discovery date of their problem would be 1981 or 1982, and that's the point at which the 8-year bar moves from there, right? So we're looking really to 1990 for redress. Is that the case? Or are we going to have to move this back to 1972, 73, and then give them that year window in order to go ahead and make their claim? Do you understand my question?
I do. Deanne Wilder is an example of a woman who discovered her potential claim against Robbins more than 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
But after 8 years had passed, and this bill would give her one additional year in which to bring her claim after the bill passes, because she already has discovered it.
Okay, so we're really having to work in the window period for those people who have the problem right now, that discovery.
That's correct.
My next question then, is that sufficient time for a person, do you feel, to go ahead and make that commitment, or does it need to be moved up?
Well, the bill would give victims of IUDs the same 2-year period to bring a claim after they discovered it as any other injured person under Oregon's regular tort claims, tort law. It only gives women 1 year from the date of the bill if they've already discovered it in the window of time between 8 years and the present. So that's, maybe that should be 2 years as well. We thought 1 year was the most we could get.
Mr. Chair.
Wondering if we're going to get closer to regular tort or.
Representative Bellamy.
Now that I've heard some examples, when you say 2 years after the date on which the plaintiff first discovered or in exercise of reasonable care should have discovered the injury and the cause of the injury, it appears to me that we'll have total litigation as to what that means.
Oh, I imagine Robbins will raise that as a defense in every case.
Well, but my question to you is, listening to the examples given, I would hate to try to determine when the plaintiff first discovered or in exercise of reasonable care should have discovered, because it would appear to me that granted these three women or two of the three women would come into your 1 year category. But if you didn't have the 1 year category, it appeared to me that they had 2 years after they first started getting medical treatment, and they still at that time didn't blame it on the IUD, so it appears to me your bill wouldn't help them.
There's a lot of case law developing on what it means to discover your injury and the cause thereof. There's no way we can avoid having to get into that area with IUDs, just as you have to get into it with almost any other kind of product that has some kind of a latency period. I don't know how to avoid it.
One further question. We keep talking about the Dalcon Shield, and I now understand the bill a little bit better when we talk about all IUDs. In this day and age, with the kind of public education that is involved, what is the justification for doing this for all IUD devices?
All IUD devices operate similarly in the sense of creating that potential latent infertility that the woman does not know about until years later. It makes the 8-year period especially arbitrary for IUD victims, just like it did for asbestosis victims.
Okay, my question would then come, why not for all products that affect this type of a situation rather than just picking out one product?
I would love to see such a bill. I don't think it's politically possible to get it through the legislature.
But right now, your prime concern is the Dalcon Shield victims.
And other IUD victims.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Colleen Francis.
Please forgive me, I have a cold.
Could you turn the other microphone towards you also, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm Colleen Francis, representing the Women's Rights Coalition. Reproductive rights is a priority issue for the coalition, and we consider the availability of safe, effective birth control to be an aspect of reproductive rights. We support the amendments to HB 2510, which would make it possible for women injured by intrauterine device to file civil actions for up to 2 years after discovery of any injury. Oregon law currently bars any claims for injuries after 8 years from the first use of a product, no matter whether the manufacturer recommended use of a device for more than 8 years, and no matter whether a woman can prove fraudulent cover-up of adverse effects of the product or gross negligence in its development or testing. The Oregon statute of repose is one of the most restrictive laws of its kind in the nation. The intrauterine device, or IUD, which has caused the most problems for women, is, of course, the Dalkin Shield. A woman who wore this device for 8 years or more, a device not recalled by its manufacturer until October of 1984, 13 years after it was first marketed, and then suffered injury, cannot take her claim to court in Oregon, though she could in most other states. Injuries blamed on the Dalkin Shield in more than 12,000 claims filed nationwide include serious pelvic infections, miscarriages, conceptions resulting in birth defective children, and complete infertility, hysterectomy, and death. The question is asked, why create an exception for IUDs? We believe the legacy of the Dalkin Shield is an exceptional situation. No other birth control method, and perhaps no other drug or device used by American women, has been blamed for such widespread suffering. Necessity for and use of birth control is a fact of life for most American women. Surveys show women assume the responsibility for birth control in most sexually active relationships. A woman relying on a birth control method places in it not only her belief that it will prevent pregnancy, but her trust that it will not injure her body. For the dozens of Oregon women who believe they suffer permanent injury from the Dalkin Shield, passage of House Bill 2510 will not guarantee redress, but will at least ensure that an accident of residency will not prevent them from having the same opportunity as women in other states to file their claim. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much for your testimony. That's all the people we have signed up on the witness sheets. Are there other individuals who wanted to testify? Yes, ma'am. Please come. If you could, so we could have you on the record, please.
My name is Danny McGrath. I gave my name, but I just wanted to be sure to say that I support this bill, and my story was similar. I had run the hospital for a week with public inflammatory disease, 8 years of pain and suffering, and going from doctor to doctor, and then a month before my 30th birthday, I had this.
Thank you very much for your testimony. So you have to speak up just a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I would like to give a short statement.
Certainly. If you could repeat your name for the record, please.
My name is Anne LaCour. And I'd kind of like to tell you a bit about my story. In 1972, I had a Dalkin Shield inserted. I had no problems with the shield for 4 years, and I was admitted to see my doctor for severe left-sided pain. He said that I had bad pelvic infection, and to promote healing that I would have to have the shield removed temporarily and I would be placed on antibiotics. The infection cleared up without further problems. I went back to have the shield inserted, and at that point I decided not to because it is very painful to have that reinserted and to have it removed. I opted to try another form of birth control, and the doctor suggested the diaphragm. I used that for 4 years with no problems, no further pelvic infections or any problems of any kind. Then when I opted to try to become pregnant, I was admitted to the hospital with severe left-sided pain and intra-abdominal bleeding, and I was rushed off for emergency surgery and had an ectopic pregnancy. And I also had damage to the right side. My tubes were damaged on both sides, so they removed the left one and they left the right one. And at no time did any doctor tell me that the Dalkin Shield caused or may have caused the injury. And that's all I want to say. I didn't find out about it until last year after seeing many articles in the newspaper and on television. Before then, I had no clue. My doctor never said this probably caused this or this did cause this.
Other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I do, I guess as a man, I can only begin to appreciate how difficult it is for the witnesses to testify about a very personal event in their lives, and I do thank people for coming here today. Yes, ma'am. Representative Burton?
I hate to keep doing this. I'm a little slow on this. Well, sorry. Go ahead.
My name is Robin Grill. I'm representing myself and I support
the bill. Thank you.
Can I ask Colleen Francis a question?
Ms. Francis? I think Representative Burton has a question.
Do you mind coming back up? Just in referring back to your testimony for a second, on the second page, say, why create an exception for IUDs, and you say that, and you point out the problems, specific problems, which we talked here about the Delcon shield. Are you aware, personally, of any other intermediate devices that have created the kind of, or any problems at all of the sort that we've heard about today?
Are you talking about name brands or just IUDs?
Well, you know, either way.
Shield. I don't know of any other.
So, in your opinion, what we're specifically addressing here is a question of Delcon Shield.
No, all IUDs, I believe, are in question here. I believe,
Counsel, I think, can help us out on this.
Okay.
Is it Copper 7 made from Robbins? That's also IUD that has caused problems.
So, it's a generic question and not a brand, product name that you're concerned about. Okay, thank you.
Counsel.
One last clarification, Mr. Chairman. On the LC Amendments 25-1, I want to draw your attention to page 2, line 22 and 23. A few words have been deleted.
Right.
Okay. Or consumption.
Thank you. I should note that there will be a hearing and possible work session on this measure as proposed to be amended on this Tuesday, and I think that's May 14th.
Correct.
Thank you. I'm sorry, are there any other witnesses on this bill? Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2510. We still have 4 or 5 measures to deal with this afternoon. House Bill 2667.
Mr. Chair, I need to make a quick phone call, so what's going to be the process?
We have a hearing on 2667, 2520, and then 3 other bills on work session.
Are the hearings going to be short?
Hopefully. The 2667, I think Mr. Barrows is, he's usually pretty brief, and we have Phil Goldsmith.
Mr. Barrows isn't here.
Mr. Goldsmith is here, though.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Thank you for spending the afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Phil Goldsmith. I'm an attorney in Portland with Henry Carey. It's actually Henry A. Carey, PC. I'm here because Representative Springer's office asked me to take a look at House Bill 2667. And after taking a look at it, I want to testify in opposition to it. Some of you may know that the firm I work with does a fair amount of complex litigation, including litigation against banks. This bill, as far as I can tell, does not affect any of the cases that our office is involved in, because there's a specific exception in the bill for subpoenas where a financial institution is a defendant. And therefore, in all the litigation that we're involved in, this bill would have no bearing. So I want you, it is my feeling at least, that, and I hope that you'll share it, that when I'm analyzing this bill, I'm doing it simply from the perspective of the public interest and not out of a sense of what it would benefit the cases that our office is working on. I think that it is the fact that there are exceptions for litigation in which a bank is a party suggests to some extent what one of the problems with the bill as it's structured. The reason there's an exception for subpoenaing records from a party to a case is that it is useful to the party, which is, at least this is sort of a general understanding of the courts, it's useful for the party which is subject to the subpoena to get the records, because they may find that the records support their case rather than the other side's case. I apologize for not having written testimony at this time. Because of other work pressures, I was unable to do the research until this morning. And unless there is some constraints on you, what I propose doing is to provide written testimony at the beginning of next week that will summarize and provide you with some of the legal authority that I'm relying on in this testimony.
Mr. Barrows, you may have an interest in this Mr. Goldsmith testimony. He's testifying in opposition to House Bill 2667.
Thank you.
Just wanted to bring you up to date a little bit on what we're doing in here. Nice of you to stop by.
In any event, the bill deals with two different types of situations. What I would call third-party subpoenas, that is, where a bank is not a party to a litigation and somebody in the litigation wants to get bank records. And the second issue, that's sections 1 and 2, and section 4 really deals with a situation where the state or a local agency seeks records. As far as I can tell, they would be individualized customer records as compared with general bank records that would be involved in say, banking commissioners in general enforcement role. I think the basic, I want to divide it between the third party situation and the state agency or local agency situation, because there's already legislation to some extent that reflects a policy decision of a prior legislature that you may or may not want to take issue with. The basic problem, I think, with the third party status in litigation is that it creates a role for financial institutions different than any other third party that's subject to a subpoena, and that it's contrary to more protective of those third parties than the provisions in the existing Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, namely Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure 55B, subsection 2, which says in essence that if there's a subpoena, somebody can file a motion to quash the subpoena, and the court can condition the denial of that motion on the grounds that the person on whose behalf the subpoena is issued paid the reasonable cost of producing whatever it is that's going to be produced. There is a reasonable amount of case decisions under the federal rules. As far as I know, there are no published Oregon decisions under the Oregon rule. the federal rule is worded exactly the same. And there are a number of factors that the courts have suggested be taken into account in determining whether a third party ought to bear the cost or whether the person subpoenaing the documents ought to bear the cost. And I want to make reference to a couple of cases relatively briefly. One of them is a case called United States versus IBM, which probably everybody has heard about in the colloquial sense, as the government's antitrust suit against IBM on generally monopolization in the computer industry. That case was in the courts for a number of years before, if memory serves me right, the president, the federal administration dismissed the case. In the course of that case, a fair amount of discovery was done from third-party computer companies. And the judge who had the case, a judge named Edelstein, who was the chief judge of the Southern District of New York, said basically that the computer companies who were subject to these third-party subpoenas and had to provide records and other information were going to have to bear the cost. And the reason he said that was...